Thank you. House Committee on Revenue for May 17, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, we have one public hearing scheduled for today, and so we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 153. And I take it, Chris, that you're it today.
I am it. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 153 deals with insurance companies and consolidated tax returns. In a situation where an insurance company is part of a consolidated tax return, when they file for Oregon, the insurance company has to be pulled out of that group and file as a separate tax return. And the backstory on this is that happened, and an insurance company paid dividends to the parent company. And during an audit, the Department of Revenue added back that dividend income. There was a disagreement, and they went to court. And the bottom line was that the court said that that couldn't have been done. And so what you have with Senate Bill 153, and I think you're going to hear some more detail, is a compromise between industry and DOR about how to codify the direction from the tax court so that it allows a 100% deduction for the parent corporation. And I think a key piece here is that the insurance company, while they pay the dividend, that's not an expense. It's not a deduction on their side. And the income is taxed by the insurance company. It's not as allowed as an expense deduction.
At the insurance company.
At the insurance company.
Gotcha. All right. Thank you. You may need to repeat all of that, but why don't you go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Members of the committee, my name is Robert Manicky, for the record. I am a lawyer at Stoll Reeves and represent Standard Insurance. And Mr. Alanak's summary was right. This bill would close a couple of gaps in the law. It was more than 20 years ago that the legislature caused the Oregon Corporation Excise Tax, our income tax, to apply to insurance companies instead of the old premium tax. And at that time, a couple of gaps were left in the cookbook of how to make that work. So when you have a parent company and any subsidiary, if it's more than 80% owned, as you know, the norm is to consolidate those two into a single tax return, treat them as one taxpayer. That means that any money that flows back and forth between them is not counted. It's eliminated under the federal consolidated return rules. So when we imposed the tax on insurers, as Mr. Alanak said, we required insurers to file their own separate tax return and pay tax separately on their own income. That's different from the consolidated return regime. The question is, how do you pull that income out of the consolidated group where the parent non-insurance company is also filing? And what do you do about intercompany transactions? Those two questions were not clearly spelled out in the long ago legislation. And this bill would fill those two gaps. Eventually, what happened is that the Department of Revenue audited Standard Insurance and brought up the issue that Mr. Alanak described about the dividend flowing from the insurance subsidiary up to the parent. The question in the litigation that eventually ensued from that audit was, does that dividend get taxed? The answer from the Oregon Tax Court was no. The dividend was eliminated in the consolidated return rules originally, and it remained eliminated when it was brought over into Oregon, even though there are now two separate tax returns. The second question was whether when you pull out that income of the insurance subsidiary and make that insurance subsidiary file its own return and pay tax on that income, do you also continue to leave that income in the tax base for the parent so that it could get taxed twice? The answer to that question did not get resolved in the Oregon Tax Court in Standard's case, because in that case, the Department of Revenue and the taxpayer simply agreed for purposes of the litigation that the answer would be no. You don't tax it twice. You don't tax it at the parent company level and at the insurance company level. You only tax it at the insurance company level. This bill is the third try in a series of attempts to codify the economic result of the Standard Insurance decision so that the law will be clear and available for anybody to see reading the statutes. There was a an early attempt standard, and the Department of Revenue have been talking to each other for the last year and a half or so. The first attempt to codify the result came in Senate Bill 30, excuse me. That was the Department of Revenue's bill. Industry rejected that bill because there were winners and losers. Standard put forth its own possible solution in the as-introduced version of Senate Bill 153. Industry didn't like that either because there were winners and losers. Now the Department of Revenue and Industry and Standard have agreed on a engrossed Senate Bill 153, which you have before you, and that is that's the consensus bill that we're proposing. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? This is the only witness on this bill. I have one. I think I followed what you said, but I'm not sure. Does that income get taxed once?
Yes. Chair Barnhart.
This bill?
Yes, Chair
and
Barnhart.
And under the law as established by the courts?
Yes, Chair Barnhart.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Anything else for this witness? Representative Benz.
Just to follow up on your question, when does it get taxed?
It gets taxed, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, the income gets taxed at the insurance company level when it files its own separate return. It gets stripped out of the parent company's return for that reason.
So the income at the insurance company level, it's income from what source is being taxed?
The income is the entire tax base as reported to it's all of its net income as apportioned to Oregon using the special insurance company apportionment factor that the legislature put forward years ago. The insurance company's tax base is net income as reported to the insurance division for regulatory purposes.
And just to follow up,
please.
So when the consolidated return is then filed, we are trying to avoid a tax being assessed then at the parent plus the consolidated insurance company level, if we could call it that, tax return filing, because a tax has been paid.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, yes, that's exactly right. So there still will be a consolidated return. It's filed in the name of the ultimate corporate parent, and it includes any other non-insurance company subsidiaries that parent might have. And so the idea is to strip out from that return the income, the separate income that the insurance company earns, and then to have the insurance company pay tax on that income. And that has been the approach that Oregon has taken now for many years. It's just that it's not been clear whether to sort of re-include the insurance subsidiary's income back up in the consolidated return of the parent.
Thank you.
How long has this controversy been going on?
Chair Barnhart, the audit of Standard arose, I would say, in about 2010. We finished litigating the matter in 2013. These are approximate dates. There was another company, Costco, and maybe there were others, I don't know, that had an issue regarding that base computation question that I was describing. And so it took a while for things to settle down before I'm presuming to speak a little bit for the department here, before the Department of Revenue initiated the process of trying to codify the result.
And as I understand what your earlier testimony was, that at one point all these businesses would file one consolidated return, and that at some point it was decided that the insurance subsidiary should file a separate return.
Chair Barnhart, the concept of consolidation is under federal law, and we generally imported, of course, the consolidation concept into Oregon law, but I believe that insurers have always been required to file separately, not consolidated.
Okay. So this question is potentially, the question could actually have been around for a long, long time.
Chair Barnhart.
And never dealt with before.
Chair Barnhart, that's exactly right.
All right.
It's a sleeper.
Thank you. Anything else? Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
What was the vote in the Senate on this bill? 28-0. Okay. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 153. What's your pleasure? Should I open the work session? Do you want to look at it again?
No, look at it again.
All right. Let's hold this over. This work public hearing work session, we'll hold this over until tomorrow. Give everyone a chance to take another look and figure out how this system works. So we'll hold that over till tomorrow, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2573.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2573. We do have two amendments, the dash 2 and the dash 3, that are up in OLIS. The dash 3 is nearly identical to the dash 2, so I'll get to the distinction in just a second. But the 2573 with the amendments that are up there, it's making changes. It's making really two primary changes in on the property tax side of things. The first is related to business personal property taxes, and the change is primarily going to be, it's an administrative change, really, in how the business personal property tax cancellation works. So under current law right now, businesses that have personal property with a value less than a specified amount, and this amount is indexed to inflation, which right now would be $16,500. So if you're a business with personal property less than that amount, your property taxes on that personal property are canceled. Mm-hmm. The change in the dash 2 and the dash 3 is to, first is a wording change, is changing that cancellation, removing the cancellation language, and just making it more aligned with an exemption, just saying that property is not subject to taxation, but it doesn't actually change the threshold or anything along those lines. So it's still that $16,500 with subsequent indexing in later years. And then it also changes the requirement on how this personal property is reported or notification that comes to the assessor. So right now under current law, there's a requirement that the business would submit a form to the county assessor, more or less stating either if it's the initial year they're trying to receive the cancellation, they would send a form listing all their personal property and showing that it is under the determined value, which would be determined by the assessor, of course, determines the value. And then in subsequent years, the personal property owner would submit a form saying they're still under the limit. More or less, nothing has changed regarding the property that they own. What the dash 2 and the dash 3 do is it requires the assessor, rather than the business personal property owner, to send out a form annually to the business personal property owner that has received the exemption in the prior year. And it would allow the personal property owner to more or less sign off saying, we have had no changes, we haven't purchased any new property, we haven't sold any of our personal property, so we still receive the exemption. So it changes a little bit where the assessor is now required to do the notification as opposed to the property owner. The difference between the dash 2 and the dash 3 is in the dash 2, the assessor is required to send out that notice. In the dash 3, it is permissive, so the assessor may send out that notice. The second change, and it's identical change in the dash 2 or the dash 3, has to do with the low-valued manufactured structures that are personal property. So these are what previously were referred to as mobile home properties, and the property tax cancellation for those properties that are in what has been determined or what it is classified as high-value or high-population counties. So the committee will remember that during the public testimony there was amendments being discussed that weren't available on OLIS that would change for two counties, Multnomah and Washington County. It would up the threshold limit right now where you have your property taxes canceled if the manufactured personal property structure is below that 16.5, and it would change that, more or less double it, up to, I believe the figure is $33,500 after the indexing for the 2017-18 property tax year. So if your manufactured structure is valued less than $33,500, then the taxes, there are no taxes on that structure. In this case, it would be Multnomah and Washington counties are subject to that increase up to the $33,500 believe the other two counties, I'm thinking it's Lane County and Marion County, would still be under the existing language, which is 16,500 as their cancellation threshold. And all the other counties, there is no cancellation threshold. So it's only those four counties that have an existing law. And then Multnomah and Washington County are the two that are having that threshold increased up. So those are the, and that change is identical in the dash two or the dash three. So it's the administrative change that differs, the may and the shall is the difference between the dash two and the dash three. We do have the paperwork on this. Happy to go through that now at this time, Mr. Chair, if you'd like.
I'm going to ask Mr. Schmidt to come in and talk about why he wants the dash three. But let me ask while he's coming. The language in the bill is actually $12,500 and $25,000, but it refers to a consumer price index for 2002. So I assume the numbers you've given us are those $12,500 or $25,000 numbers translated by the CPIs that have occurred since that time to the numbers you actually gave. Is that accurate?
Exactly, Mr. Chair, yes.
All right. Very quickly, before you, when I came in and you caught me on the way to the podium, you raised the proposal that we ought to be looking at the dash three rather than the dash two. Would you explain from the assessor's point of view why that is? What's the importance of that is from where you sit?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Douglas Schmidt, Polk County Assessor, testifying for the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. The dash three makes it permissive to the assessors to mail the letter out. The way my process works is several years ago, the legislature took out the requirement for us to mail a personal property return to every business owner in the county. So what I do is every 3 years I mail out one to every person in every business in the county. And in between that, I pick a threshold, about $10,000, and I will mail those people a return. So what this bill would do under the dash two would require me to all of those businesses under $10,000 to mail a letter out to them and then have to process it when it comes back in. And a lot of these are low value, $5,000, $6,000, $2,000 properties, and it just the requirement that we shall do this, it puts a burden on assessors and in cost. There are some assessors I know. I talked with Washington County, Multnomah County. They do send out personal property returns to everybody. But in some counties, that smaller counties that may have some fiscal issues, we have tried to streamline and put our effort into the properties that are going to get us some additional revenue, and it's typically not going to be those $2,000 and $3,000 personal property reporters. So the dash three would allow us to the option, if we want to mail something out, we can. But if we don't think it's necessary in our specific county, we wouldn't have to.
So the dash three allows a judgment call on the part of the assessor.
That is correct. Chair Barnhart, that is correct.
And I'm assuming, based on what you've just described, is that number that you only send out every 3 years to is a very large number as compared to the number of people you send out to every year.
I have 1,100, 1,200 personal property counts, and there's about 400, 450 of them that I do not send returns out to in the off years. So in the years where I send out returns to everybody, it'd be about 1,100, 1,200 accounts. Mm-hmm. So that keeps me from having to mail and process and process them when they come back in, because they're just not going to be over the threshold. And we really don't see an issue, at least in Polk County, where if people may not get a return. One year they got a return, and then the next year they don't. And we may get a handful of calls every year. Why didn't I get a return? I got one last year. We just explain it's the policy for cost savings that you won't, but you will get one in a couple years. And the people that we talk to are fine with that, as long as they know that they're not missing filing something.
Right. Now, you have a lot more returns that are required to be filed every year, because they are over the threshold.
Yes, out of the 1,100 or 1,200, there's 590 that are under the 16.5. So the remainder of that, the 600-700, are the ones that I would have to send something out every year. But I choose to send out I choose to send out returns at a threshold that is less than the 16.5 in case they have bought a piece of equipment that would bump them over.
Yeah.
And I know that there are several counties that are doing the same thing I'm doing. In fact, I think there's quite a few counties that are not mailing to every taxpayer every year because of cost savings and time and staff.
Great. As far as you're concerned, this bill works with the Dash 3?
Chair Barnhart, yes.
I mean, you can administer.
Yes.
Your colleagues can
yes.
administer this bill if it's approved.
It gives, Chair Barnhart and committee, it gives the assessors who want to notify a taxpayer every year, like some of them do, they can still do that. They may send out the actual return to the taxpayer instead of the letter. But if I want to send out a letter to the taxpayers that are under the threshold, I can do that, but I don't have to do that. And I don't know if I should bring this up or not, but there was a fiscal that showed up, I think, in the Dash 3 that is too high. It was something that I submitted to the Legislative Fiscal Office, and they didn't put in my reduced numbers on that. So it's about $70,000 instead of the 126 on the Dash 3. So I don't know if that is something that I should even bring up right now.
Well, I think probably you should. Where are we on that? Do we have the fiscal?
Mr. Chair, we do have the paperwork on both. We got them just before the hearing got underway. The Dash 3 and the Dash 2 both have the same number, about $130,000 in cost. As Mr. Schmidt has brought up, the $130,000, that is if every assessor is required to do this in the mailing. So if there is discretion given to the assessors, then that $130,000 figure would probably be something less than that, because some may do this every year, others may not, and that the $130,000 represents kind of the high water mark if they all do it. So it's reasonable to probably expect that it'd be some proportion of that, assuming not all the assessors, or I guess they stick with what they're doing more or less now today, is not sending it out every single year.
Well, let me make sure I understand. Assessors are sending these things out anyway. Is that right?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, no,
we're not.
This would, like I said, I don't send a return out to every taxpayer every year. This would require me to send out a letter to the taxpayers I don't send a return to, but those 400 or 500, I'd still have to send a letter. But under the Dash 3, I don't have to send a letter. It's permissive to me, so I could keep doing what I'm doing now, so there would be no additional cost to me under the Dash 3. Under the Dash 2, there would be additional cost to assessors, because it requires us to send out something to every taxpayer every year, whether it's a full return or it's just a return to some and a letter to others.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I'm reading from the fiscal impact of proposed legislation Dash 3, and I think it says what you just said, that if the notice is required, the Dash 2 would cost $126,000, but the Dash 3 is permissive, so you can opt to mail a notice or not, and therefore there's no...
Actually, Chair Barnhart, it could actually be indeterminate of the cost, because
right.
some assessors will continue to mail now, whether it's a letter or the
right.
full return, which some do, and other assessors may choose not to mail anything except for every couple of years.
Right.
And that's where I don't think that the fiscal that showed in the Dash 3, I thought, was correct, because it almost sounded like we would be doing the exact same thing under the Dash 2 and the Dash 3, and we're not.
Yeah, actually, it doesn't say that, because the new form would replace the existing declaration. No additional cost would be incurred for processing. However, there might be an additional increase in call volume related to the new process. You might get more calls from taxpayers.
And Chair Barnhart, may I just mention something?
Please.
Under the existing law, and I talked with Kyle about this before, I'll just be honest with you. The law required that a taxpayer send us a certification if they didn't receive a statement. If they were under the threshold, they were required to send us a certification that they had not added any new personal property. They weren't doing that, and we didn't force them to do that.
And this, the Dash 3 amendment, does that change that requirement?
Mm-hmm. The Dash 2 would change it to where assessors had to send them a letter.
Correct.
The Dash 3 gives us the option to contact the taxpayer if we believe, with a letter, if we believe that it's warranted.
But but it removes the requirement that the taxpayer contact you to certify that they've not gone over the threshold unless you send them this form.
Chair Barnhart, that is correct.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize that I do not recall this vividly from when we first heard this bill. but what is the reasoning for increasing the cap for manufactured in just those two counties? That's probably not you.
That's Washington County.
Yeah, I don't want anything to do with that.
He's coming. Okay. Yeah.
And it's in two counties. I mean, the...
Right.
I'll let you take this one.
Okay. Yeah. For the record, Jim McCauley, Washington County. Yeah. Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith-Warner. The request basically comes from the commissioners from both Multnomah and Washington County who want to raise the exemption level from 16.5 to the 33,500. Reason being is that when this law was originally enacted back in 2010, the threshold was set at 12,500, and the idea was to try to cover some of those low-income families and essentially take or provide them with a little bit more financial stability to stay in some of that housing. The valuations since 2010 have blown past essentially where they were at that point in time, and it's essentially just catch-up time. So the CPI or the indexing hasn't kept up with the valuations that have gone on. So effectively, we've lost several hundred units that no longer qualify for this exemption because of those increased property values that are out there, and that by going to this $33,500 cap, we've got a lot more headroom effectively for the future, and actually will almost double the amount of units in Multnomah and Washington County being covered by this.
Yes, please. Yeah.
But this is, I thought this was for business taxes.
Representative Barnhart, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, there are two parts to this bill.
One
deals with business personal property. The other deals with the increase in the manufactured home exemption.
Just a handy relating to clause?
Correct. Yes.
Okay.
That's what it is.
Thank you.
Washington County was graciously allowed to hijack Representative Gomberg's bill in order to bring up this other piece. This is one of those situations, isn't it, where we're dealing with very low value housing.
Exactly.
And in one sense, it can be thought of as working with the legislature's concern about making sure that Oregonians are housed, mm-hmm. including low-income Oregonians.
Exactly.
Chair Barnhart, that is very much the fact. I mean, this is probably the best, I'll say collectively around $700,000 both counties could spend on stability for that affordable housing stock.
Right, and of course, you also have difficulties. You're talking about a fairly small account, and you're going to have difficulties collecting some of it because people who tend to live in this sort of housing may have fragile finances. Sure. And so there's a bunch of reasons, aren't there, in addition to simply not trying to collect it.
That's correct. It becomes prohibitive for the assessors on the collection side of this as well, because again, you're talking about low value folks, and again, people who financially are literally one step away from the streets in some respects. And sometimes this housing stock is effectively the first step off the streets into some stability and a roof over their head.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair, and I'm glad Rep. Smith-Warner raised this issue. I'm not necessarily opposed to the $12,500 to $25,000, but does it send the wrong message to the other counties that we're allowing two to have that threshold increased while others do not receive that?
That one I can answer. My understanding is that the other counties ask to keep the level where it is in those counties. I'm not certain exactly why, but my guess is that the inflation in values is not as acute in those counties. Do you know?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith, I think that's a pretty good accurate portrayal of the reason why both Lane County and Clackamas did not want to be part of this higher amount, is talking about different valuation structures. And again, I'll go back to the 2010 legislation when we first had this conversation. This housing stock, when you get out of a more urbanized county, is a very different mix than what it is for Washington County. So if you go to Coos County or Wheeler or something of that nature, you're looking at a much higher, I'll say, percentage in those valuations that are sitting within this housing stock than what you're going to find in our particular urban counties. And we have, I'll say, more ability to absorb some of that impact. That's also part of the conversation.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with any of that. Did we reach out to the other counties just to get their insight to see if they would like to participate?
Yeah, Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith, yes, we did.
Cool. Thank you.
Representative Marsh?
Thank you, Chair. I was just going to share data that just came to me in terms of Jackson County, which we have the number two. We are number two in the state in terms of parks. We have 3,200 park spots. So this is the manufactured home community is a significant part of the property tax base, actually.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense. Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question. About the differences between the Second and Third Amendment, and I know you're requesting it, but this is only applicable to Multnomah and Washington County, and you said it's not.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Representative Hernandez, the manufactured home increase in to $33,500 for the exemption of that value, that is Multnomah County and Washington County only. The business personal property portion of this, where we would have to send a letter out to the business personal property owner, that is statewide.
Okay.
That is statewide.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. We're in work session. I think we're ready. Representative Smith Warner, do you want to move the dash three?
Sure. Mr. Chair, excuse me, I move the Dash 3 Amendment to House Bill 2573.
Representative Smith Warner moves the Dash 3 Amendment to House Bill 2573. Is there any further discussion? Mm-hmm. Objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Representative Smith Warner?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I ask unanimous consent that we reopen that vote so that Representative Marsh may vote as well.
Any objections? Representative Marsh, the question is on the adoption of the Dash 3 Amendment.
Aye.
Yeah, she votes aye. All right.
Okay.
To the floor?
Yes, please. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2573 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Smith-Warner moves House Bill 2573 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. We'll ask Representative Gomberg to carry the bill. He'll have to learn about the other half of it. And with that, we'll close the work session in House Bill.
I give him a heads up.
On House Bill 2573.
That's good humor.
He has a heads up.
Colleagues, we're going to open the work session on House Bill 2286, but it's not ready to work today, but Chris is going to give us an update on where we are. So that will open the work session on House Bill 2286. Chris, tell us what's going on with this one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to refresh everybody's memory, House Bill 2286 deals with tax credits, but mostly about processing and administration. There are three components to it: the transmittal of certification data to the Department of Revenue, the revocation of tax credits when policies aren't being followed, and some aspects to transferability. The idea is that it's largely cleanup, and the intent is to take advantage, part of the intent is to take advantage of DOR's new computer system so that they know ahead of time when taxpayers are allowed to claim certain tax credits, so that can be checked against the returns when they get filed in April. So it's mainly a streamlining process. Right now, Legislative Council is working on another amendment. We have a dash one, but that's going to be replaced by a dash two that cleans up a lot of this language, and we've been communicating with all of the agencies to make sure everything is okay. And the starting point, a lot of agencies are already providing the Department of Revenue with certification data. This just formalizes that. It's the intent is not to create any new process or new burden on taxpayers. That would be a subsequent decision for the legislature to take up. And then the revocation language, the goal there is to have a core revocation language that would be in statute, so that at a future time when the legislature wants to invoke revocation, they can point to that statute while also allowing particular tax credits to have unique revocation provisions that are related only to their tax credits. So there'd be that two aspect to the revocation. And then the third piece, the transferability, would apply prospectively to tax credits that would be transferred in the future, and would allow them to be divided up, if you will, on an annual basis to facilitate the transfer of those tax credits. But again, it's forward-looking, so the intent is to have a bill that has a no or minimal fiscal, as well as a no or minimal revenue impact, and we're going through those details to ensure that is, in fact, the case.
All right. Interesting. Questions for Chris or additional guidance? I think you have permission to go ahead. That's great.
We're hoping to have an amendment by tomorrow's committee meeting that we can share and distribute. We'll see. I don't want to presume to speak for alleged council's workload.
Do you want me to carry over the work session?
So we could carry it. You could carry it over, and so that if we do get it by then tomorrow, we can distribute it.
Okay. All right. Well, let's carry over this work session on House Bill 2286 till tomorrow. We got a bunch of things that we've added to the calendar for tomorrow. Colleagues, anything else on 2286? For that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2286. Anything else for today?
Wow.
I think, that means you have 50 minutes that you hadn't planned on, 55 minutes to go work on something else. And with that, the committee is adjourned.